It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
They might talk about humor, music, film, books, football, and box sets, exercise, and maybe even food. Trivia and sport, politics and health, sometimes well-being too. On the Life with Brian. On the Life with Brian.
Here we are again then. Welcome to Life with Brian, the Brian McClare podcast. Mark here with Matthew on hosting duties. How are you, Matthew?
I'm very well, thank you, Mark. Good to see you.
And you. And thankfully, Brian McClare has shown up too. How are you, Chucky? You been up to much?
Well, it was quite interesting to flick through the occasions where I'm waiting to do things like this onto the television. I came across a documentary program about people talking about their experiences of writing for Rolling Stone magazine. So I quite enjoyed an hour of watching and listening to that. And also another little aside is that me and my brother were accused of stealing somebody's remembrance plaque off a wall in a pub.
Recently?
Yeah, last week, 2 weeks ago, yeah.
And you're obviously going to say it was nothing to do with you and it was a terrible mistake.
Well, we didn't know it was there because it wasn't there, you know. So there was some screw marks on the wall, you know. We're like, why would... I think it was something to do with redecoration, but this person who was close to the person whose name was on it thought that maybe that we brought our own screwdrivers and things with us just for the, you know, we're collecting. We look like two guys who collect remembrance plates off various different places, you know.
You have got that look about you.
So that's what's been happening to me. Yeah.
All right, well, we'll skirt over that subject just in case anybody from the Airdrie Constabulary is listening. And we'll introduce our guest. He's a broadcaster and journalist who's a very familiar face on our TV screens as a key part of BT Sport's live Premier League and European football coverage. He's usually found asking the difficult questions of players and managers, so hopefully we'll be able to turn the tables on him. It is, of course, Des Kelly. Great to have you with us, Des.
Absolute pleasure and a privilege. Looking forward to it. Fire away is what I say. I like the biblical theme, Matthew, Mark. I was expecting John and Paul, but of course we have Brian. That's got sort of Monty Python-esque. It works really well.
Well, we can do plenty of Monty Python. No problem. You can spend an hour just talking about Monty Python if you want.
Excellent.
I'm sure Brian's got more up his sleeve than that.
Maybe not. It's surprising and intriguing that how colourful of life you have had, if the internet is anything to go by. There's something that leapt into my right away about what I would like to ask you about was going back to May 2004, where you find yourself going from, if I'm right, the assistant editor of the Mirror to becoming the interim editor of the Mirror, and it happens so quickly because your gaffer gets if the reports are right, gets escorted off the premises. How did you deal with that? Was there any idea that was going to happen, or how then do you know that you're not in charge of a, from what again, gather a body of individuals who had great respect for the editor who just departed? What do you learn along the way to be able to, you know, what do you say? Have you got a strategy? How do you get them ball back online or such, and back into producing work for the paper, which is almost immediate, isn't it? Well, would certainly almost immediate. You've got to get them back into a frame of mind to do the work.
It kind of get the paper out. It was a chaotic time. I can't say it was a happy time at all. How can I put this sort of diplomatically? We didn't get on too well, me and the editor, for quite an extended period of time. But we did work in the same building, and we both had jobs to do. It was a messy situation. It's a very complicated thing. We'd spend an hour talking about it, but it was a bit of a mess, and it had been dragging on. And when the editor left, I thought the best thing to do was just to draw a line on it and say, hey, we were hoaxed. Sorry, move on. I tried to just do it that way, which caused plenty of fuss as well. But I thought that was the best way to do it. And it was a sort of turbulent time above in the hierarchy in the editorial department. So it was a bit of a mess. I'd been there for 7 years, and I'd been deputy editor, and then they made me acting editor for a while, which was a strange title. How can I tell you this without infringing certain?
I know what happened. Happened afterwards. I was just wondering what happened at that moment. You know, all of a sudden you've got
that moment was a mess. I stood up to be
like in football terms. Yeah. The manager gets sacked. Yeah. You're stepping in.
It's exactly like that.
How did you cope with that? What was your idea of doing? Or
first instance, it's the same as a football manager. You get the paper out in the same way you'd get a team out and get them to play. And it was as simple as that. It was about getting the paper out day to day, and that's the way I kind of did it. Really,
was it ever your intention to take that role? As were you just sort of happily?
I would have been very happy to be the editor of the Mirror, but it didn't really work out. I didn't get on too well with the hierarchy after that because there were lots of cuts, etc. happening, which I didn't necessarily agree with. So after a while, I was escorted from the building myself. So that's the way of the world. I enjoyed a lot of lovely people at the Mirror, and we did some great papers. I was much happier there because it was a left-leaning paper. It was a popular paper. I think it had so much more potential. But it's still running. It's still doing well. And a lot of people I hired are still there. And it's lovely to see them there too as well.
Another thing that was really interesting is rallying. Did you do rallies?
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I do with Tony Jardine.
You're not driving.
I'm the co-driver. I'm the man with.
You're the one that says 15 yards left and all that.
And if you get it wrong, it's a terrible, terrible accident. He didn't actually. Tony Jardine nearly killed me in Belgium. I'm not exaggerating. We had a crash. We went over a humpback bridge, and the two at 100 and something miles an hour. One side of the car dug in to the tarmac, and the other was on gravel. And the car took off and went. Pretty much from a goal kick to the edge of the other penalty box. And I was taken away with a split crash helmet and taken for an MRI scans. And there was a helicopter and all sorts of flaws, all that fuss. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I'm not ruling out doing another one, but my 12-year-old's not too chuffed about it, but we'll do another one. He's a special guy, Tony Johnny, very good driver. And it's an awesome experience just to be in a massive event like that. We did three Rally GB, three Arctic rallies. That's awesome. So it's been fantastic, but apart from the crash in Belgium.
One of the reasons we couldn't record with you earlier this month, Des, was because you went to see the Skids in concert.
Yes.
Richard Jobson, who we've recently had on the show. So tell us about this love of music for yours and where that passion came from.
We'll start with Richard Jobson. He's a legend. Went, as you said, saw them in the Fleece, which is a smelly, sweaty, beer-throwing hall of nastiness and fun. It's great. It's a brilliant venue. And I've got tickets to see Killing Joke next week, but at the same place, actually. So, but he was fantastic. I know you've done a podcast with him. So I was the warm up for him for a different podcast a couple of weeks ago. So I know his funny stories were coming out in between songs. Fantastic anecdotes, because he's selling his book, of course, as well. And it was really, really interesting. Great fun. But the energy he had was fantastic. It was great. Really enjoyed it. And yeah, music is life, isn't it?
Well, for those of us that can't see, there's a guitar in the background.
Yeah.
In your room there. So, I mean, I've heard on the grapevine, it might well have been on that podcast that you just mentioned, that you were somewhat of a frustrated singer in a band. Is it a frustrated Brian Ferry? Would that be fair to say?
I wouldn't overstate it, really. We might think we are after about six pints, but yeah, it's just for fun, just for fun.
But you were in a band, though, weren't you, years ago?
Oh, was it? Yeah, a couple, actually. But I'm going back a long way now. We're talking 20s, early 20s. Yeah. And we played some gigs around London in Mayfair and some strange places. It's sort of post-punk stuff. I can't really convincingly say we were brilliant or I was thwarted by fate. It was just great fun to do at the time. I've got quite a musical family, so they're all Irish and they love a good sing song. So when we met in the sixth form, we did some mates. We still play together and we get to, so a couple of weeks ago, we had a little get together here in the house. The neighbours loved it because it went on till quarter to six in the morning. So. I had to bribe them, particularly as one of them turned up with a drum kit.
I get the feeling your musical tastes are somewhat similar, you and Brian.
I think we're probably. I couldn't find anything at all on the internet about you saying anything about music. Nothing.
I'm not a professional musician.
But even what your musical taste was, I mean, apart from that, found out that you'd been to the Skids, there was nothing that I could find, you know.
So my musical taste.
I knew you'd presented some music program on BT, though.
My musical tastes are very eclectic, from Radiohead, Roxy music. I around that time when we were doing the band's thing, I loved all that sort of art house, sort of post punk, sort of. Not even New Romantic, you know what I mean? That kind of Bowie, Japan, Roxy music. I loved all that stuff because it was just a little bit different. But my tastes are rich.
You'll have to get Jobson's book that he wrote about the aliens. Have you read that one?
No, I haven't, but I want to after seeing the gig, because in between songs, he would have a little break and he'd tell a two-minute, three-minute story and had the whole place howling with laughter. He was great fun. But we met him before. I went to the Isle of Wight Festival and we were watching. Rusty Egan came down from Visage and Ultravox, and he was doing a DJ set at the Isle of Wight, and he wanted to get into the, we had a BT bar where we could watch the World Cup. And all this stuff. So, and Richard came and joined us. He was just a smashing guy to talk to.
Where was your earliest musical influences? What were they? Can you remember what music did you have in the house? Did your mum and dad have a radiogram?
Right, definitely the radiogram, yeah. The one with a little wooden thing, you open it up at the top. It was all old school Irish, from Slim Whitman to Jim Reeves to, you know, Glenn Miller as well. So a lot of Irish music in the house. So my mum and dad used to sing and play as well. So it was nothing strange. They would play in Irish clubs across London because that was their sort of second income, undeclared to the tax man.
You may be dropping a minute now.
when we've had guests on the past, we've put them on the spot. I remember we did this with Pat Nevin and various other people, and we've asked them their first single they bought. Brian, obviously, we all know by now, Brian's was Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. What was your first single, Des?
The one I personally bought, because there was a lot of music in the house, so I couldn't really. The one I could remember would be Boomtown Rats or something like that. It'd be early. That would be around that period. I mean, but we had a lot of music coming in and out of the house. It was like people used to swap records. You never necessarily bought it until you'd listened to it a few times. So you'd borrow from other people and mates and that kind of thing. So, it would be something like very early Boomtown Rats or something like that. I think the first concerts I went to was Squeeze, Boomtown Rats, and The Jam, the first three, and The Stranglers were four.
You're painting a picture there of what, late 70s, early 80s?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Diz, you're going into, let's say, your Fleet Street days. Your patch a few years back was very much the Northwest, was it not? So I just always wonder when we have guests on whether you've crossed paths with our esteemed host in the past. Were you covering United back in those days? Or
circuitous routes. I used to work in London. Then I went up to Yorkshire because Howard Wilkinson was on. It's my first proper job up there. He was leading towards the title that year. And I was at Today newspaper. And I used to have to go into the Northwest a little bit and in and out just as cover. And then I actually sort of switched over to Merseyside for a little while as well. But so I miss Brian. Brian, did you do interviews back then? Not many.
I had not such great experience, I suppose, when you're talking to reporters at the time, in the sense that you end up getting, that I felt end up getting stitched up by the headline, you know. So, and which is, you understand, it's a part of the learning thing, isn't it? You know, yeah. For example, when I was at Celtic, somebody had asked me, because when I was at Celtic, so I was at Celtic 83 to 87, there was a sort of a game more interest in continental football throughout UK and Scotland, and it was about Italian football, because Joe Jordan had been in Milan and Graeme Souness was at Sampdoria. So I was asked the question, you know, do you ever think about playing in, do you ever think your career might end up in Italy? And of course, you're a young person at the time, you just treat that as a question of, oh yeah, that would be quite nice, because you're thinking also about the cultural side of it, you know.
Yeah.
I hadn't really spent any time there in Italy, I have since, but you know, when you go to Genoa or you go to Milan, you can see why it might be a bit more attractive in certain parts of the deepest, darkest Lanarkshire, you know. Not that I'm a massive fan, I don't like the sun, but the sun doesn't like me, you know. So I just go from blue to white to red, back to blue again, you know. So I got asked this question about it, and you do this thing, and then it comes out in the paper on the Saturday morning, and the headline's about, I'm going to Italy. This is the headline in the paper. And we're playing, maybe it was pre-season, so anyway, we were playing a game against Dumbarton, which is in the lower echelons of the Scottish Division, in another part of the world that isn't that a wonderful place. And you're trying like really hard. It's not going that great because it's a pre-season game and you're a bit rusty and all that kind of thing. And at the end of the part of the game, I went to get the ball because I was always in a rush to get on with the game, you know. I hated the game being static, so that's why you see me going around at the goals all the time. I just wanted to get me restart. So I'd go and get the ball. Sometimes be ball boy, you know, and go and get the ball and go and take it to the corner or whatever. And I went to pick up the ball, and it's very narrow between the pitch and the terrace. I went to pick up the ball, and I just looked up, there's a guy right in front of me, and he just said to me, "Why don't you fuck off to Italy now?" Which was, I suppose, an interpretation or a comment on how I was playing on that particular day, you know. And I'm like, for fuck's sake, you know, like, I've only got into this team here, and I'm like, you know, I can accept it, the reason for that. So, and then there was various times through that, but when you're involved with Alex Ferguson, who I'm sure you've come across many times in many, many different moods, it becomes almost a sin to be doing something without his blessing, you know. Mm. And you're running a massive, I mean, you're getting a hairdryer or a torching, or in certain circumstances, ejected from the club, depending on what you might have said or what you might have done, you know. So you're running a sort of risk at all points, you know. So I'd rather risk my career or my Manchester United career during the everyday in the training field or on the pitch during games, rather than joisting jousting, sorry, with the media, you know. So I just kind of went just kind of the other way and just had very little to do with it, you know. So
as I was saying, I was doing Yorkshire Beat with Ron Atkinson was at Sheffield Wednesday, Dave Bassett was at Sheffield United, and Howard Wilkinson was on the way to the title. And I had to fill in for whoever was doing Today newspaper in Manchester. But in the... So I'd got some information about Ryan Giggs' contract, which was spot on. I mean, it was right down to the details of his... the car he wanted, which I think was a Ford Escort. Certainly, times have changed. I'm pretty sure it was a red Ford Escort he'd asked for in a specific kind of car. And it was all kosher. And I can't tell you why, but it was. Anyway, so I did the story. It was fine. Didn't think about it at all. Went down to Carrington. Oh, no. Went down to the Cliff in the old days. The old days. Cliff. So went to the Cliff and... I went in and said, so all the sort of Manchester pack were sitting there on the wooden benches outside, and I said, good morning, Alex. Good morning, Alex. I said, I'm Des Kelly from Today. I fucking know who you are, is what he said. I fucking know who you are. I'm fucking disgraced doing that contract story. I was hello. That was my first introduction to Manchester United and Sir Alex Ferguson.
and that's why Brian never used to do interviews. Saying that, though, Brian, I'm as the fanboy that I am of you, as you well know, I can only think of two post-match interviews you ever did for United. And one... was after the 90... Well, one was after Newcastle away and then FA Cup fifth round in 1990. Yeah. You and Danny Wallace, and you completely took the piss out of him live on BBC, which was classic. And the other one was after the 94 Cup final when there's you, Pallister, Keane,
yeah,
Paul Parker, and you're there again making funny jokes that no one else seems to get. I mean, I just wonder whether it was just not for you, those sort of...
But see, those things are a little bit different, though. And it's somebody asks you a question and those kind of things. It's your interpretation of how you want to answer the question, you know. So these are the things that used to pop into my head all the time. But like live on the television, there's going to be very little doubt or room for manoeuvre from the other side. So you're quite confident in that whatever you're saying, whether people understand that or not, is going to come across exactly like that. If I'm sitting down over a cup of coffee with a reporter from the local newspaper or any newspaper, they can use whatever I say to interpret it, whatever they decide the story wants to be. And I just got fed up with that sort of thing. So, but when you're doing live stuff, and just like go say whatever in. And there it is. It comes across with whatever way people want to interpret it, or whatever way people see me. That's how. That's me. That's what I'm doing. In the written press, it was completely different. And I say you would be able to say, and I'm sure Des has said the same sort of thing. You got and go, that was a fucking joke you did last week and all that kind of thing. Maybe there's a good article and go, I don't like the headline. That's the sub editor. And their ass is covered from that. You know, we did it in good faith and all that.
Yeah,
that's just what happened then.
It's changed now. I think the days of the newspaper setting the agenda is kind of drifts away because there's so many different access points. So much, most players actually quite enjoy talking. I think whether they're on, particularly on TV. I get what you're saying. I think it's more complicated now, isn't it? Because you've got rights of reply. So if they misquote you, Brian, you can have a Twitter account, an Instagram account. You can go into the whole thing. It's more complicated now. I think there's sort of black and white of newspapers. When newspapers had control, it's dissolved now. It's dissoluted.
I just wonder how you would have been different today, Brian. Because I remember that Newcastle. I remember that Newcastle interview vividly as a kid. I was about 10, 12. The reporter said to you, because Danny Wallace set you up for one of the goals, and you said, "What's the first pass he's given me all season?" Deadpan. And then the draw had come out, and United were away again, and you said, "We're away again, so we couldn't be happier that away draw, just what you want in the cup." You know, and it was sinking in when I was watching it as a kid. I was thinking, this guy's taking the piss, you know, on TV. But nobody cottoned onto it. Now, knowing you and what you're like, I can see exactly what you were doing.
It would have been the same. I would be doing the same thing. I'd be trying again. Get this. There's lots of things, and you've heard lots of stories about things I used to do that would be entertaining myself at the training ground, and a lot of it was Fergie was in the middle of it, and I still don't know how I got away with a lot of the stuff that I was doing. There's, I mean, some of it was really close to the edge when it came to any kind of humour, never mind humour that it can be seen publicly within the cliff. So I think I potentially would have been banned from social media by Alex Ferguson because I'm taking the piss constantly. That's what I was doing, because I wanted to be entertained. Still want to be entertained like the things we're doing now. And a lot of the times because I had to generate my own entertainment. So, and these things used to just come in. And I've always, like, a bit like, I don't know if it's so much been influenced by Monty Python or it comes from your dad, with a dry sense of humour. I've always had this dry sense of humour, but maybe it's like, you know, you watch things like Monty Python and Spike Milligan at the time, and you think, no, this is stuff that's... And I really liked that kind of thing, that you something. It wasn't immediately funny, you know. I still liked the comedians in the 70s and 80s that would no longer be given a platform now, where it's a traditional joke. I've always liked traditional. I still like jokes, and I like to tell jokes, but I liked that kind of thing about people saying, well, that's not funny, you know. But I thought it was funny, you know, because it was relevant.
Funny's good,
you know. So.
You just don't want boring. I'm quite happy. If somebody comes in and starts taking the piss or telling jokes, that is a good interview.
I was just thinking that, listening to knowing you, Brian, and knowing what you were like, and listening to, you know, knowing your style, Des, I'm just thinking whether you'd have loved to interview Brian in his pomp. Well,
the deadpan thing would just work great.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd get killed for it, but I'd get sucked. But it'd be great.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Something else is going to really ask you about this in the sense of what you're doing, right? So you're doing something that is, I liked your quote that I saw, that you're getting paid for voicing your opinion, right?
Well,
I
think it's good watching football.
It's great, and you're getting to watch football if you love football and all that. But then you're getting, your job is to interview people. And I like the idea that sometimes it's easy, you said, it's easy to interview the winning manager, and it's a bit more touchy, a bit more difficult to interview the manager who's lost, right? So when I'm looking at your little thing the other day with Steve Gerrard, right? Yeah. And I'm thinking that for what you said, right? Well, the question you asked was a factual question.
Well, it wasn't really so a question, was it?
It's a factual question, right? So everybody's, that's one of the things that kills Nick, that irritates me, because we've covered it now with a raft of analysis in the numbers and figures and number crunching and all this other, and assists and all this push. Now, it is, when you tell, and I use a lot of things when I'm watching United games recently, particularly the game, the derby game at Man City, and I know because I've watched the whole game, they ain't had a shot at all. Nobody has to tell me that they haven't had a shot on target. Right? They haven't had any attempts on goals, and I'm sitting and going, now forget all this possession and all this, I'm thinking, how can it be in a derby game, such a derby game like that, Manchester Derby and Manchester United have not had an attempt from anywhere, right? Not even a speculative one. So when you're asking that question to the team, you're absolutely correct. They did not have a shot on target till the last minute. Now, does the reaction then please you? Because that's more interesting television, isn't it?
Well, there is that.
I don't know if it was me, like, and he went to the end and shoot your hand and all that. That sort of the drama to me, that's like almost a wee mini play, right? That there's no script to.
No, there's no script. You're hanging your backside out. I treat every interview as a potential career-ending moment. And I'm absolutely not exaggerating because you could get right into right trouble. I do 100, 150. Maybe more interviews every season. It's very rare they go a bit weird. The Steven Gerrard one, you just darts because his side is well beaten. And I get it. I mean, if somebody stuck me in front of a camera and says, that was rubbish, why were you rubbish there today? I'd go, well, I'm over there. You know what I mean? I can see why managers get irritated, but it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, but
Stevie got grumpy because I pointed out the fact that he'd given his couple of answers, and then at the end of the one part, I went out going into too much tedious detail, but he said that we were much better in the second half. So my response was, yeah, but he still didn't have a shot until it was literally the last minute of the game, and he just got knocked about it. That's fair enough. He's allowed to get knocked, and as you say, it's good telly. I'm not pleased by that reaction because that sort of puts you in a really awkward situation. And I was trying to, because I get all right with him because he used to work for BT as well, by the way, and that might be part of it. Maybe he thought I was going in a bit hard. I didn't think I was. But I tried to negotiate a path out of it so we both look reasonable at the end of it, as opposed to both of us, anybody having a massive strop, because that doesn't really help. So, yeah, it was no big deal. It's fine. As you say, it's kind of, everyone starts getting excited and they complain about it, but that's what you want. A little bit of spite, a bit of a laugh. You want something that goes beyond, we'll focus on the next game, blah, 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 the usual sort of. I mean, the parameters are quite narrow, full stop, you know, in terms of what you can talk about. We're talking about a football match. It isn't quantum physics. We're talking about a football match. So the parameters of the discussion are quite tight. The time factor is a big deal. I mean, if it goes beyond 3 minutes, producers start to panic because this is a long time on live TV. So everything's condensed. Everything has to be just structured in a way that you can get in and out, get everything you need, you want covered, and then you can go. So it's tight. Sometimes it gets a bit fraught. Sometimes people misunderstand, or sometimes people just get in a strop, and that's fine. Or sometimes I ask a terrible question. But if we can get out of there with a bit of dignity, that's fine. And if everyone gets the message out as well, that's also good.
But do you find there's almost a sense of pressure on you now? I mean, I'm not saying you instigate it, but do you feel now that there's almost an expectation for you to have these post-match interviews where people think, oh, is Des going to ask him this, or is it going to...
I don't quiz people. I tend to have a conversation like we are now. I get lots of the old hacks telling me, you didn't ask a question. You gave him a statement. I'm like, yeah, I do. Sometimes you do, because that's how you have a conversation. So if people get upset about it, that's up to them. I don't think there's any expectation about it. I've been doing it for years, 7, 8, 9 years. In TV, and before that with newspapers, but in TV I've been doing it I can remember on one hand things that have gone wrong. Stevie G was probably one, and if that's a bad one,
I wouldn't say that it's gone wrong. I don't say that got in at all. There's no negative thing about it at all.
Yeah.
It's just I was interested in that. Does it, you know, without being saying that, well, your intention is to create a situation that's that can be dramatic like that.
Yeah, it doesn't really help, actually.
It's just a situation that occurs, and you'd rather it didn't happen, but it doesn't be quite good television, I suppose.
Yeah. And people like the reporter getting a kick in sometimes, and if you get one over on them, but you don't actually set out to do that. I think sometimes it just takes on a life of its own. You forget that you're actually on telly if it goes to a little level. You're defending yourself in some respects, and it's exactly what the manager's doing as well. So I understand it, and I just try to get out of it if it goes a little bit strange.
Mm. So Gaz said the line of questioning then, and is it right that you would have liked to, or you would like to sit down with Monsieur Cantona?
Oh, Eric, yeah, I did actually. I've talked to him a couple of times back in the day. It looks like when he won awards one year and he was.
Yeah, if you could interview him, is there a few questions you would like to ask him in particular?
I don't think it would really matter what I asked. He'd be off on some. some psychological trip or something else. He'd have his own message there. I think that would be quite fun on live TV. He'd probably be a nightmare on live TV. I remember him going to the UEFA FIFA thing, or was it UEFA event, and he was just speaking from the podium and nobody was really quite sure what he was talking about. But a fascinating chap. No, I didn't interview him properly, no. But I met him a couple of times and he was...
What would you ask him?
He was a lot more introverted than I imagined he would be, actually.
It's a facade.
Right. It's the persona he wants.
It's his suit. He puts the suit on. Yeah, that's what it is. He puts that on, you know. He psychs himself into being Cantona, where he's actually Eric.
Is he like that then? Off air? I mean, if you were sat next to him on the coach or in the pub or the players' lounge?
Well, I mean, what kind of struck me, one of the things we were doing before lockdown, he was doing me and Clayton Blackmore were his warm up act at a theatre in Nottingham. And we met him before, I hadn't seen him for a while, we were chatting away and great. He's just a normal ex, you know, glad that he played football where he on quite well and appreciated what he did. And quite, I can understand a lot of things about him. But then when he was when he got the shout of, you know, like 10 seconds to go on stage, he actually went away. But for a minute before, he went away from us, away into a corner of the theatre on his own, and he came back out as Eric Cantona. And you're a massive fan of, you're a big Marvel fan, aren't you?
To me, what sort of?
Well, anyway, he came out as if he was wearing the super Cantona.
Oh, yeah.
He had the same clothes on, but he was like,
"Elders back."
He strode out of that stage, and all the punters, because it's a captivated audience, are all over there and singing and all that kind of thing. And he stood there, waiting for the crescendo to die down, and he stood there posing. And I was pissing myself laughing at the whole thing, you know. Felt like going on stage and going, "What the fuck are you doing, right?" Can you not go back to that guy who was just talking to us a few minutes ago? And he goes on and he does what he does, and the people in the audience loved what he was saying and how he looked. But for me, that was the kind of thing. Then you go back to playing with him and training with him and all that. You could see how at times he decided this is his coping strategy, really. So how does he cope with being this mythical football player, really, you know?
That's how he worked himself into acting.
Yeah. Somebody asked, I wonder whether he does a similar thing and kind of dons the cloak of character supposed to be him. Is another one of your compulsive viewing interviewees of recent times, Jurgen Klopp. Obviously, when you spoke to him after that game at the Amex, and your producers, I think, gave you significantly more than the 3 minutes to interview him about scheduling and all that sort of thing. But Jurgen Klopp, I always find myself waiting for the mask to slip with him. And I wonder if you get to see a different side of him other than this sort of jovial German clown who can switch in a moment to quite a taciturn, spiteful character? Or do you think that that's part of a role that he plays now that he's, you know, he's perfected it over the last 10 years with Dortmund and now at Liverpool? Do you think that's how he is?
I don't agree with what you said in many respects. I don't think he's put on an act at all. I think sometimes he's over jolly, but a lot of people do that because they're trying to project a certain sort of persona. But he's generous in his answers. He's got opinions on everything, but they're pretty measured. I think the way he prepares his team, the way he deals with his team is very good. I've had an argument with him, but, you know, I've done probably 60, 70 interviews with him. I did his first interview when he landed in the UK and all that kind of... I just understand that some people just are in a shitty mood sometimes. If they've been beaten or if something's gone wrong, they're going to be in a shitty mood. But most of the time, people have a decent chat and a conversation. I have no problems with him. We did have an exchange on TV, and it was because he literally pointed and said, you, you know, thank congratulations, particularly, and we know everything, put it, everything that happened, but it became personal then, so it's fine, I have to engage. You said it was more than 3 minutes. Yeah, it was 8.5, which is an eternity. Everyone was having kittens because I'd been asked to wrap it up a couple of times, and I completely ignored that because I thought I can't wrap it up because that means it looks like I've given up. And we nearly ran into the Manchester City game. So that was being broadcast live during the pandemic then. So it was a 3 o'clock kickoff. So we literally ended the interview and it went straight to the Manchester City kickoff. So it was a lot of flustering. But no, I think I like Klopp. I understand he is sometimes sarcastic. He is sometimes narky. But yeah, that's okay. That's part of the package. Again, he's engaging. He's a big character. I think he last season. I think when he was struggling with all those defensive problems. Yeah, I think he was in the right grumpy mood most of the time. So whatever you asked him, you're going to get bitten back, or he'd give it a go. But no, as a general, I think he's as a general rule. I think he's great. He makes my job easy. Answers well, analyzes the game pretty well. Speaks at length. Has a colourful phrase from time to time. I'm fine with him. I think he's good. He makes the Premier League better from my perspective, if I'm being selfish about my job, and I'm sure Liverpool fans like him full stop.
I think it's a shame we don't get to see your face and your reactions during these interviews like the Klopp one or the Gerrard one, because, you know, you must get sick to death of, you know, hearing the stock answers that you get from particularly the players or when a manager's trying to cushion the blow slightly of a poor performance or a defeat. But when it does go a bit sideways in these instances, it would be great if it was a side-by-side interview rather than, you know, you're behind the camera or you're not in shot to see, you know, because you can hear your exasperation sometimes when you're not getting what you want or you're getting something that you don't quite agree with. It would be so much better television if it was a, you know, we were getting you in there as well, I think.
Maybe not, but funny enough, in that Klopp exchange, well, it was more of a debate. It wasn't really a row. He said, "Don't make that face at me during the exchange we were having," because I was going, because he pointed the finger and said this, that, and the other, and it was anyway. I think Klopp is good for the Premier League. I get the Manchester United view of him, but I think he's been great for the Premier League. I think he speaks eloquently in terms of, you know, Brexit, in terms of the way the clubs were trying to keep the COVID tests private when you think it's when everyone else has to be public about it. So I think he's on the right side of most big issues. So I have no problem at all. I enjoy his company.
On that subject, I assume this stuff doesn't carry over. I assume it's sort of hit at the moment, and then a couple of weeks' time, you're probably interviewing him again.
I was doing it literally 48 hours later because they were playing my Ajax at Anfield. So now he came out, he was still grumpy.
Oh, was he? Because that was going to lead me on to my next question. Brian, you'll know about this. I mean, Alex Ferguson, Sir Alex Ferguson, would harbour grudges for a long time, as we well know. And I just wonder, you've obviously interviewed him in the post-match environment, but post-match accessibility to managers seems to be much more the thing now. I think years ago it was outside the dressing room door, it was, you know, in the before they were going to get on the coach. Now there's almost an obligation to do this sort of straight up.
Oh, there is,
you
know, contractually obliged.
Well, yeah. and I just wonder how Sir Alex would have dealt with the modern way. I can imagine he'd never talk to a lot of people ever again.
But I think you forget that to actually do half-time briefing, that's what he used to do on ITV. I think the managers realise the platform they have now and the persona they can project, how it benefits them. Arsene Wenger used to say that even if I'm talking to you, I'm not really talking to you. I'm talking to the fans, I'm talking to the boards, I'm talking to my players sometimes. So they know how to use it. I think it's become part of the circus. And I think some managers use it very well.
What do you think, Brian? Did you know about his spats with the media when you were in the plane? In the dressing room, would he make it public, or was it a case of?
No, you'd read about it in the same way everybody else did. You know, because you were never there. They were never there when there was the press conferences were. And you could see whatever they said on the television. But he like they said, he adapted to that because he had to. You know, so that's what it was. I mean, I think I think all the way through the my far as I'm aware, that the media have been pushing and pushing and pushing to actually get into the dressing room. For, you know, in some countries they go straight in after the radio and they go straight into the dressing room.
American sport do it as well, yeah, a lot.
You know, so they go straight into the dressing room. I can't imagine what I could and Buzz were like, and some of them even with one at times, you know, we've still had a
record, yeah, I think there's,
you know, so I mean to be able to go in and stick a microphone up some the manager or somebody's any manager, never mind after a game, win, lose or draw, I can't imagine how that could be.
That happens anyway now, because if it's a big final, I'm straight on the pitch with the microphone, yeah, straight in the face of the goal scorer, somebody else wanders in, then the manager comes across, so it happens like that. It happens, but that's normal. That's what you want to be in the middle of it and try and capture some of the emotion, some of the joy or disappointment. The disappointment is much harder to deal with than the joy, but you capture some of the emotion and people feel it in the stadium, and to be on the pitch and in the middle of it is a tremendous privilege. Complete imposter when I first started doing it. You thought, well, why am I even standing here? You feel like you've just trodden on some holy surface, you know, you're in the wrong place altogether, but you get used to it, I suppose.
Have you ever run on the pitch when it's been wet and slipped and fell on your ass?
Many would love to see that. You'd probably grip me if I was there.
Have you got some grips at the small on your shoes?
I don't run that fast anymore, bro.
Just thinking of these, you're talking of this as a modern phenomenon. I know it's not, because you said, Des, you've been doing it for the best part of 10 years now. But
oh, no,
I'm asking the question to you. I'm thinking there must have been some greats that have obviously before your time or that got away that you never had the pleasure of doing this without. I mean, imagine doing a straight after the match interview with Brian Clough, or
Brian Clough would be incredible, or a disaster, one or the other. I think in his pomp he would have been fantastic. He would probably slap me all over the place, I suppose. Alex, I didn't really do post-match because there wasn't that, the contracts were different. There was ITV and terrestrial TV, but I did interview him for previews, like I think it was Juventus, where he came out with a fantastic quote about if the Italians tell me it's pasta, I check under the sauce just to make sure. And it was that, because he was trying to pressure the referees. So yeah, so Alex has a great turn of phrase.
I'm sure he would have evolved as well, wouldn't he? I mean, that's I'm just thinking of the famous one that springs to mind, Brian. I've got visions of you sitting in the dressing room at this time. I remember the game well, a 3-3 at Anfield. United came back from 3-1 down, 3-3. Gordon Strachan scored, and the post match interview, which was probably never even heard. No one's ever heard of it. It must be on the radio somewhere. There's that famous spat with Alex and Kenny, which I think it was a radio interview. It obviously wasn't done in its the way it would be now. But Alex went up to Kenny, and Kenny had Lauren, I think, in his arms at the time, and said, "You'll get more sense out of her than you will him." I mean, if that was now, that would be absolute gold. But it's still spoken about in folklore. I've just got visions of you being in the other side of the dressing room door, thinking, "What the hell's going on out there?" But maybe you knew better just to leave him to it.
If it happens on camera, it happens on camera. If it doesn't happen on camera, I try to stick to the you know, what stays in Vegas. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Oh. So there was one almighty bundle there. I can't tell you what two clubs were, but one of the backroom team had started abusing the other side in, let's say, Italian. Of course, one of the other backroom team, the opposing side, spoke perfect Italian. So it all kicked off. And the club came in and said, "You can't discuss that." I said, "Yes, I can. I can do whatever I like." I said, "We won't bring him in." I said, "If you don't bring the manager in, then I will tell you people on air why you didn't bring the manager in. So make your mind up." So the compromise was, I said, "Has anyone been punched? Anyone been manhandled or assaulted in any way?" No. And I thought, well, that's just people shouting at each other. Who cares about that? So yeah, being in there is is great, but you can't just go blah, 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 everything you see, because it destroys any credibility you may have or may have left, shall we say, in my case.
As well as people that, you know, Matthew just asked you about people who you would have liked to have had in front of the camera immediately post-match, is there anybody out there now or in the past who, you know, when you see them walking down the tunnel towards the camera, you think, oh, God, not him? I mean, you don't have to name names if there is anybody specifically out there now who you do have to work with, but
yeah,
I'm sure there must be people who you don't really, not that keen on. In an interview sense, I don't mean necessarily personally.
I've touched on it earlier. The boring ones are the ones I really can't engage with because I don't get anything. So Manuel Pellegrini he was aloof and kind of polite, but not really. It's like Emperor Palpatine out of Star Wars. It was just sort of energy vampire. I couldn't see any good thing coming out of it. Claude Puel. I mean, oh God, no one thinks about Claude Puel, but he was just boring. I mean, just boring. And he once accused me of being a Liverpool fan because I asked him, I think they were playing Leicester. I just suggested to him that Harry Maguire was lucky not to be sent off. And he started talking to me, are you a Liverpool fan? I went, no. It's just very strange. And God love him, Bielsa. Marcelo Bielsa, it's a great achievement. He got Leeds up. But for me and my job, I'm not talking about Leeds, I'm not talking about management, I'm not talking about tactics. But for me, it's a catastrophe because he just stares at his feet using a translator. And the only time I've ever had eye contact with him was very recently when he got that second shoeing from another to get the game. It was essentially his last, because I said to him afterwards that teams have worked you out, haven't they, Marcelo? Is it time to compromise? And as he always used to stare at his toes, eye contact, really angry about that. And his translator, he said something to his translator, and the translator said, was you at the game? He's from South London, proper South London. Was you at the game? He said to me, not were you at the game, or did you see the match? Was you at the game? And then, from that one, that was it. So they were, it's the ones that are difficult to talk to. Jose Mourinho used to be an absolute, I mean, he's not the worst. I wouldn't say he's the worst because I wouldn't use that. He's the one that really keeps you on your toes. But he can just open up with anything. He'll go off on one. He's very clever at running out the clock in the way that, you know, we're 1-0 up and there's 3 minutes to go. If he doesn't want to talk about something, he knows I've got 3 minutes or any interviewer, he'll try and talk it out. Also, he'll fire questions back. Klopp started doing that recently as well. So just, well, what do you think? For instance, if I said to Jose Mourinho, why did you struggle out there today, Jose? And he'll say, well, how many shots did they have on target? And if you don't know the answer to that, or if you haven't checked on the way in, he will put you away. So I if you say, I don't know, you're in trouble. If you say, well, they had 2 shots on target, and then he will say, well, see, they struggled as well. So he can... He would do that, but I genuinely enjoyed with him because he got the whole concept of showbiz, and he knew that he could cause a stir. He knew he could deflect. He knew he could tell a story. Sometimes he'd just be flipping angry, but I really enjoyed it. So speaking of sort of little tit a tat sort of a conversation. He dropped Pogba. I can't remember what game it was. We were abroad at a European game, and it was the first sort of early days of the problems with Pogba and Jose Mourinho. And I asked him why he wasn't in the side, and he said something. He didn't really answer it at all. And then I asked him again, but what's happened with Paul Pogba? And I asked him a third time, and he said, well, why have you asked me about Paul Pogba 3 times? I said, because you didn't answer the first time. So that was the end of the interview, and it was a little bit spiky. So after the game, I thought, well, I won't ask about Pogba straight away. I'll ask one question. I'll mention Scott McTominay, and then I'll talk about Paul Pogba. And as soon as I said Scott McTominay, this is what Jose does. He says, that is a great question. Can I hug you? So I get this hug on my TV, and the whole interview goes somewhere else. You know, so he could get himself again. He could work himself up into a fury, or he could just be a real beautiful actor. Get himself out. But he always kept Johnny Terms. He would come out 2 hours before kickoff. I haven't even got the team, and he'd scribble the team down, unintelligible, and. And off we go, as live. Yeah, he probably, obviously, I'm quite great. A great deal of that is possibly what Jose.
I was going to say maybe managers are getting savvy to the post-match or the press post-match interview, but it's not a new thing, is it? I mean, Clough was like that. Fergie was very much like that. You know, Brian, he would very much turn it around on people and the whole deflection game.
But the difference is, I get the first one if we've got the rights, like Sky do as well. They get the first one on their days. But now there's a sort of chicken run of broadcasters. So once he's done that first interview, they then do four, five, six others down the line, you know, for America, for all across Europe. So it becomes a little bit of a sausage machine. So the first one is always the best one.
Yeah, so if you were at the end of that pecking order, it must be a pretty thankless task, I imagine.
I have been when the it's Juventus against Real Madrid in the Champions League semi-final. I'm miles away. I'm getting some left back who came on for 3 minutes at the end of the game. So yeah, it's a bit like that.
I remember years ago, you know, you'd come out of a dressing room or a tunnel, and it was a free for all. And it was whoever got the first question in, and whoever was there with the microphone got the. Now it's a lot more regimented, it seems. So.
Yes. Once everything goes up.
Yeah.
I was interested because you watch a lot of the because of your job, you watch a lot of Champions League football, European football. Have you got any opinion about Ajax manager Ten Hag?
I found him very. Again, I'm talking from my perspective in terms of he's decent. He's speaks well. He's pretty clear in what he wants to say, and his Ajax side did really well to get to semi-finals. That he was very close to the final. Just that momentous game in the Champions League against Tottenham. Yeah, interesting. I don't know. You don't know. All these you can name all these names, but as soon as they go into the Manchester United job, things are different. You may have a fantastic reputation, you may have won things everywhere, and then you step into Manchester United and it becomes a very different scenario than maybe some people expect.
You don't know anything, Brian, do you? You've got any whispers?
No. Yeah, well, it was just the stuff that was on there.
There's four interviews going, isn't there? At least
stuff today was supposed to be that he'd had a reasonable interview for the or he'd been interviewed for it and it went the way it went. So I don't know. I think there's a dearth of top coaches outside the ones who a lot of the ones we've spoken about already. Maybe they're not getting the opportunities or enough time to become. Good coaches. That's one of the things I've always kind of liked about the Italians is that they're not afraid of re-employing coaches after a period of time. You know, there doesn't seem to be the same sort of thing that once you've been the manager of, you can never be the manager of again. They seem to be a bit more, I don't know what it is, but they allow them to have other opportunities. Our top coaches have done quite well, other opportunities, whereas here it just seems that you get your opportunity and that's you finished in the Premier League, you're never to be seen again, you know, pop up in somewhere else in across the world, or you go back to it and then maybe you can come back to something else. But he is from what I know, he's a disciple of Guardiola, so but the problem he's faced isn't the same problem he's going to face with everybody else, that he'll be going into somewhere where it doesn't matter how good a coach you are and how good an interview you are, and Des has alluded to that, you're only as good as what you've got to in front of you. So if Des has got somebody on it that knows he's going to be boring, it's not going to be much of an interview. If you're going into a football club and you think that the players are not quite what you think that they should be, you can always have an influence of them, influence over them. That's what you'd expect from anyone. But you can only have a certain amount of influence on whether they're good enough or not. Whether it is a squad, is it a balanced squad, is it a team, is it not a team? And it's going to change.
Yeah,
that's going to change in the summer. And that's got nothing to do with any influence that anyone can have at a particular club, because players are out of contract and they're going to do what they want to do, to the right thing for themselves and their families, which is understandable. The thing that for me at that club at Manchester United is that I think the recruitment is a problem, not the recruitment of managers. I think the recruitment of football players.
I've spoken to Ralph Rangnick quite a lot, and he's quite open in terms of he manages to sort of sound diplomatic, but drop a few.
Yeah, he's good at that. Yeah, I like what he says.
Yeah, me too. I'm same. I like to hear a lot. He's not really. It's not digging people out like some managers have done in the past. He's giving an assessment about the game, and he doesn't entirely, he doesn't wrap them in cotton wool. But I don't feel he's German. Whenever I hear him talk, I think he sounds Dutch, because he's really open in the way. If you meant the Dutch always have a row and they always say what they want, like Louis van Gaal used to and everything. And Rangnick has that sort of feel. It's been very difficult for him to grab hold of the squad, isn't it, and just get them all going one way.
Yeah, there's one or two little things that he said that for me like are interesting, in the sense he says something about a player, but I'm thinking, what is he saying there? He's saying, well, I like him as a person, or I like him as a player. Well, what actually are you saying? He's saying, it's not good to Manchester United, because you like him as a person, you don't like him as a player or whatever else, or you think he's a problem as a player. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing that I think he's got nice subtleties when it comes to that regard. But the problem with it, and I think Mark's faced that, is that you can be beaten down by social media and certain particular things of social media, you know, and you want to be as candid as you can you should be as candid as you can with the support, and then you can be. You can be battered because somebody else sort of might throw something out onto social media. So your thing today, your thing you're talking about Jose Mourinho, and you've got a player who's not exactly saying that his depression or parts of his depression is down to the way he was treated by a particular manager, but you're going to read into it lots of different ways, aren't you, to do with. So does it help? It always helps to talk, and I think it's always good if anybody says... they have had problems with their health, particularly when it comes to mental issues. I think you should be able to say, look, I'm no different from anyone else, but do you have to turn around and say it was a specific period, you know, under a specific person? I don't think that's going to be particularly helpful to the other party, because one of the things that I've always been kind of understood or been aware of is that in football, and certainly in football, it's that you could be with one manager you didn't really have a relationship with, and you could then say whatever you thought about that manager and move to another club, and they could be the next manager. And all of a sudden you're in this position, and then you're like, oh my God, he's now, what am I doing? And then before you know it, you can be in a place where you didn't desire to be, only because it was what your opinion was at that particular time, rather than realising that the opinion that matters, whether you like it or not, is that person who picks the team. And when you look at it, usually they pick the team based on what they think will win the game. And sometimes it'll be down to how they think that you have been behaving, you know. And that's not just at the training ground, that's in could be external issues as well.
I think that's
a small world football, as you know.
Yeah, well, Jose turned up at Roma and a couple of the players had fled to Roma to get away from it. Suddenly, dun, dun, dun.
But on the flip side of that, though, Brian, I think I've asked you this before for whatever it was, I can't remember. But when you went to United, Alex Ferguson was very much part of that move for you. 2 years later, he could have left. Very nearly did, by all accounts. And then where does that put you in terms of where you, do you want to stay or did you sign for the manager? I mean, I know it didn't happen, but hypothetically you could have signed for a club that 2 years later, the whole project was completely different.
Well, yeah, that's sort of thing that happens, isn't it? You know, so when that happened, I did experience that right at the beginning of my football careers, you know, that for example, when I was went to Villa as a 16-year-old, Ron Chandler was a manager, Aston Villa won the league. He told me that I could go back to Scotland for whatever reason. And then shortly after that, Tony Barton ended up as a job, got the job and went on to win the European Cup with Villa. And I know that Tony Barton liked me as a player, so so given a little couple of weeks, my whole career path could have been completely different. And then when I signed for Motherwell, I signed for Alan McLeod, who had been Scotland manager in 78 when we went to Argentina. And then within weeks, he had gone, and his assistant got the job, David Tay. And David Tay, at the end of that season, he left to go to America. That season, there was Jock Wilson and Frank Connor came in as the management, and I left at the end of that season having had Jock and Frank shouting at me constantly, and then went to Celtic with Billy McNeil, who left after I signed and never it was pre-season. He left to go come down to England.
You didn't get the hint by this stage,
and then the manager then after that was David Hay and Frank Connor. So I'd gone through this early part of my career thinking, well, what have I done wrong here, you know? And then you end up with having Alex Ferguson as
that. So Fergie, in a way, was probably the longest serving. The writing was on the wall there. As soon as you signed it,
I was thinking, well, what is this canoe? And I hadn't said anything. I mean, I wasn't in a place that anybody would really ask me about the situation with Alan McLeod or David Hay or,
you know, that
Frank or Billy McNeil or anything like that. You know, just I was just like, well, this thing, you know. So the first manager who signed me, who wanted to sign me, was Alex Ferguson. So
40 years since the Aston Villa European Cup win. 40 years. Don't want to depress you, but
you're claiming credit for that, Brian, are you?
No, I'm going to tell it for the league win the year before.
You have played for three teams that have won the European Cup, haven't you? Have you not?
Yeah, I did play. But,
no.
I played for the youth team, if that counts, yeah.
McClare's mailbag. McClare's mailbag. McClare's mailbag.
You spoke, we listened. So over to Matthew with this week's mailbag questions.
Okay, here's one from Dennis, and it's for Brian, and he says, which team in history would you have liked to have played in?
Lisbon Lions.
Yeah, simple, yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing else. Did they absolute? I mean, we know that was your... We know that was the team.
Well, you can't say Italy now, can you? I mean,
the Lisbon Lions. I fell in love with football because I saw a recording of the Lisbon Lions. So, for me, that would be the one. I met loads of them, and I've sat there listening to them telling stories, and I was the only audience there. So you're in that, and they were treating me like as I was one of them, and it made me feel that. Probably the best experience I've had as a football player outside playing football, sitting there, and they were insisting to tell them that one, and it was an amazing day, really, for me. So it'd have to be them, you know.
And would you have played the early mid-80s McClare up front role, or the late mid-90s McClare midfield creative role?
I would have been quite happy being the kit man.
Is that a team, Des, that was, I mean, talking about your background and everything, I assume the Lisbon Lions would have had some kind of influence on your family.
No, not really. No, God. I'm wondering how Brian saw them because, I mean, look, how old am I? I think we're nearly the same age, aren't we, Brian? Nearly. But I wouldn't. Was there like football then? We didn't get.
No, you didn't watch it live. You watched the recording in the school.
I know, but you wouldn't. Like, it's not something that I would sort of hoover up back then. You just hear them as mystical figures. No, you used to get your FA Cup final, a couple of internationals, and the European Cup final. That's all. We were restricted back then.
Well, that leads us on to our next question, actually, from Cumbrian Dave. And he says, for Des, which past or present sports person do you admire the most, and why?
Oh, crikey, that's a hard one. It's kind of a stock in trade question. I have no proper answer for it. Dennis Law, for the totally non-sporting reasons, other than that I blagged a ticket for my dad at Liverpool Manchester United. And my dad was sitting with Dennis Law, who's a lovely man. And they didn't come out for the second half. They stayed in the director's bar and drank for the second half. There's something really fantastic about that.
That's a great reason, because as I read that question, I thought that's like one of those shoot or match questions that you would have got, Brian, in the old days and probably made up some story. But to say, what's your, and it was always Viv Richards or someone like that. I think you did say that. But to give that answer and that reason, I think that's great.
She enjoyed my old man sitting there with one of his heroes, just watching the match on the telly, sitting at the bar. Lovely. I mean, I kept looking up, going, where have you gone? There's some empty seats there. I'm in the press box. So, anyway,
That puts Dennis Law even higher in the estimation, knowing that. Talking of ex-sportsmen and just bringing the tone down slightly, the mood down, Cumbrian Dave says, Brian, you're a big cricket fan. It was a sad news about Shane Warne's recent passing. Would you say he's the greatest spin bowler of all time? I don't think you could really disagree with that, could you?
No. I mean, you look at people were talking about him when he was alive, saying that these were things that, and since he passed away, they're talking about him potentially being the greatest cricketer. You know, what the kind of thing I liked about Shane Warne was that he was a very, very shy lad. He was a bit overweight when he was a kid, and he overcame all this sort of stuff to become the spokesperson that he was, or the cricketer that he was. And also, you look at that, not only was he very good at that, he was clearly decent at coaching, and he was a wonderful, for me, pundit. You know, I think that's one of the things that I love about cricket, is listening to people talking about cricket. It tends to be ex-players that do that on Test Match Special and on whatever channel the cricket tends to be on at the moment. You know,
so. It lends itself, because of the time scale of the game, of the whole day, it lends itself to stories. But I did some corporate stuff with them, Shane. It's an experience.
I don't say he would have been there with your dad and Dennis Law.
Dennis Law wasn't the whole day. Halfway through, you'd be doing something on stage and you go, can I just take a little break? And he'd be outside, I'm trying to come back in, carry on. It was full of energy, good stories, and charming to everybody. It was great fun.
Does your love of sport go beyond football, Des? I mean,
but it's football's. It's the be all end all, but the other stuff's okay.
Talking of extracurricular activities, Anonymous sends a message in, and Brian, and says, do you know entries for Celebrity MasterChef are now open, and are you interested?
You're talking to me?
Yeah, of course.
No, I'm quite happy just messing about in my kitchen. That would put you under too much of the spotlight, and I don't want to be.
I think you do yourself an injustice. Having sampled your fantastic lasagna,
you find when you dig into a little bit more, and you find out a lot of these other people are doing, they cheat, don't they? So they're getting lessons all the time from one of my mate that's a Michelin star restaurateur. I'm sort of struggling when it comes to Michelin star mates, you know. Well, that's just a little question for you, Des. Actually, I wanted to ask you if you don't mind, just some food and drink.
You can ask whatever you like. Doesn't mean I have to answer it.
No, you don't have to answer it. Just this is one thing that just this is the way that pops in my head. What I wanted to ask you was, do you always drink Guinness when you're eating oysters?
Not always. No, I drink many things. The oysters there are hard to come by. I was had a lovely Christmas in Ireland. It was fabulous. We went over to Galway. And
home of the Oyster Festival, isn't it?
Look, that's lovely. What a lovely Christmas we had. It was nice just to get away, but to do it in Galway is fantastic. But, by the way, in terms of reality shows, because they're all horrible, I think, and ghastly. The idea of skating or something just me
seeing
my mouth. Yeah, I mean, why would you all do that? But maybe some people do. But MasterChef is the one you would do. That's the one that would I'd be okay with that. Nothing else. No celebrity whatever jungle thing. No, none of that. But MasterChef has got some kudos there. That's good.
Well, funny enough, we had Rowetta from the Happy Mondays on the other, a month or so ago, and she asked Brian the same question, and he gave his usual stoic answer. He didn't give much away, but
I've embarrassed myself enough playing football without embarrassing myself in front of several hundreds of thousands of other viewers, you know. And my thing's always been the same kind of thing all the days. When I first started out was that my gran used to get the news of the world, which is, I can't understand why she used to get it. Right? She'd go to Mass every Sunday, and then after Mass, she would go and get the news of the world and send the news of the world. And one of my goals as being a football player was not to be on in the news of the world, apart from the back page or the other two or the back five pages, not that I was particularly not to be on the front page or the inside.
Seven times a night, jockey.
Whatever it is, you know. Because, and so I sort of think about that they've been replaced by my adult children, you know, thinking that, what's your dad doing? Look at your dad, he's this, you know. Because they occasionally, not very often, but occasionally they'll get because I've got an unusual surname, they'll get occasionally, you know, was your dad? Is that your dad? You know, that sort of thing, you know. So I think hopefully it's not too detrimental to them. But I think when you go on things like that, and I think that they would be the ones that would get the stick for it. But if you're doing it, you're doing it for whatever reason you're doing it, and you just accept that's why you're doing it. And same thing with being a football player. You develop a rhino hide, so it doesn't really matter what people say or what they think, because you've already got a view of where you're at and what you're doing. So I just think that's and then you can't get rid of it, can you? You know, it's not as if it's like nobody, very, very rarely that every single newspaper will be able to be found like that article.
Brian McClure's running eggs.
Exactly, yeah, you know, can't even cook an egg, you know, can't even whatever, you know, burning things, whatever it is, you know, and then anyway, and as you know, that being involved in all this thing, what I've been aware of right from going back when the Man United captain's log stuff came out, I did most of the filming for both of those things. That's why I'm not in very many of them, because I was doing a lot of the filming, because it just gives I could film on the bus, because the manager didn't mind, because it was me filming, you know. But he had sort of some editorial control over it, as you can imagine. But all the time, when it comes out, I was just thinking, this is dependent on who thinks this is what's going to be interesting. And then after that, you can see, and I'll just think about the people who might be sitting down, particularly if it's something to do with some normal life, you know, and you're being portrayed, you know, sitting down with all your friends and your family, maybe your gran and all that, and they come and go, oh, look, we're going to go on this. And you're portrayed as a complete and utter wanker. You know, and you're sitting with your mum, your dad, or whatever else, and just because that little part of that wee tiny bit, you know, you had a bad day, you know, but they've taken that out, and that's your main contribution to this. So I can't watch any of those things. I just can't watch them. I mean, I couldn't watch The Office because that made me cringe, even though
that wasn't real.
Yeah, you do know that wasn't real, Brian.
But it was based on reality. And I'm like, I'd never worked in an office. And I just thought, but people, but, oh, this is so.
Yeah, blame the edit. That's what I do.
But don't put yourself in the situation where you're getting edited.
Yeah, in fairness to Brian, he never said he was going to do MasterChef. We basically said, you know, I know you've got a love of cooking, and having experienced your lasagna before, which now my mum can never cook a lasagna again because she'll always say, oh, it's not going to be as good as Brian McClure's. we put him forward for it, but he's not, Yeah, unless I might apply in your name.
Oh, thanks.
But we decided that's the only one that would be relevant to him. But what about you, Des? Would you do any of the
reality? Only Master, nothing else.
All right. Well,
Mastermind.
No, I didn't. But did I say that?
No.
Maybe Mastermind, but that's a different thing. I need to find
I saw David James on there the other week, and he didn't do very well. So maybe that encouraged me to think I could do better than David James. I think he got three.
you could be inspired by John Higgins, Brian, and go on there. I think that's a wrap, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, okay, gents, that's the final whistle. We'll all shake hands and swap shirts. Des, thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Pleasure, honestly. It's been great fun.
Thanks.
Lovely to meet you. Lovely to meet you.
So to keep abreast of what Des is up to, obviously tune in to BT Sport on a weekly basis, and you can follow him on Twitter and Instagram at TheDesKelly. Matthew, Brian, thanks very much, chaps.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, and thank you, Des.
Thank you, Matthew. Thank you very much, Des.
Gentlemen, thank you. Honour and a privilege, as I said. Thank you very much. Love to see you, Brian.
Thank you.
As usual, before we sign off, please don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Brian McClare Pod, and don't forget to hit subscribe on whichever platform you listen to us on. Thanks so much for listening, and take care until next time.
Life with Brian. Talking films or music. Life with Brian. Talking TV and food. Life with Brian. Talking trivia and exercise. Life with Brian. It's different every episode. Life with Brian. Talking politics and football. Life with Brian. It's different every episode. Life with Brian. Life with Brian.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.